Who would take a job as Donald Trump's lawyer? Representing the famously volatile former president is a tricky job, to say the least. And he's hired and fired his fair share of attorneys over the decades. But among his staunchest legal allies has been Jones Day, one of the largest law firms in the world, a firm that provided lawyers to help Trump fend off various investigations and laid the legal groundwork for him to contest the 2020 election. Jones Day started in Cleveland in the late 19th century and has risen to prominence with clients including big tobacco, pharmaceutical companies, and Russian oligarchs. The story of Jones Day and similar firms is told in the new book, Servants of the Damned, Giant Law Firms, Donald Trump, and the Corruption of Justice by David Enrich. David is the finance editor of the New York Times, and he joins us now to share five big ideas from his book.
Hello, my name is David Enrich. I'm here to talk to you about my latest book, Servants of the Damned, Giant Law Firms, Donald Trump, and the Corruption of Justice. I've been covering business and finance for nearly 20 years, and I have often bumped up against huge law firms during my reporting. I've been fascinated by the power that they wield, which only rarely gets scrutinized in the mainstream media. So I decided to write this book. Here are five key insights I picked up along the way. 1. The legal industry wasn't always about short-term victories. A lot of people think it's obvious that lawyers at big corporate firms will go to the ends of the earth to help their clients win at just about any cost. That wasn't always the case, though. Servants of the Damned starts with an anecdote about a disaster in Cleveland, Ohio in the 1940s. A pair of tanks containing natural gas exploded. An entire neighborhood was leveled. A lot of people were killed, many more were injured, and a ton of property was absolutely destroyed. The company that owned the gas tanks asked its lawyers at Jones Day to figure out what they should do. Jones Day was a law firm in Cleveland that represented some of the biggest companies in the Midwest region. The explosions took place on a Friday. The lawyers spent the weekend researching case law. There were a bunch of ways to potentially handle this. They could try to blame others, like the companies whose materials were used to build the tanks, or maybe the city's water and sewer authorities, because the gas had traveled through their tunnels. The lawyers could downplay the damages the victims suffered. Or they could try to just delay and protract the legal proceedings, hoping the victims would either accept lowball financial settlements or would simply give up and walk away. But after barely 48 hours of studying this, Jones Day lawyers reached a different conclusion. The gas company should admit fault and pledge to make victims whole. So that Monday, the company ran an ad in the Plain Dealer newspaper inviting victims to simply show up at their offices. Jones Day lawyers helped set up tables in the lobby and to write checks on the spot. The result was that the community basically forgave the gas company, which continues to operate in Cleveland to this day. 2. The legal industry didn't even exist until fairly recently. Law firms weren't always the cutthroat, profit-crazed places that you see depicted in movies and TV shows today. In 1977, two young, idealistic lawyers in Phoenix, Arizona, were starting their own legal clinic. It was going to offer cut-rate legal services to poor people, the types of services that public defenders wouldn't provide and that larger law firms wouldn't bother with. The problem was that the two lawyers, John Bates and Van Osteen, had no easy way to get the word out to the community about the services they were offering. At the time, state bar associations prohibited lawyers from advertising their services or otherwise promoting themselves. Lawyers generally weren't allowed to talk to the media or even hand out business cards at cocktail parties. It was all part of an effort to insulate the legal profession from the commercial pressures that existed in other industries. Bates and Osteen decided to challenge these rules. How else, they figured, could they get the word out about their new clinic? They bought a small ad in the Arizona Republic newspaper, letting people know that their clinic would charge only about $75 for a divorce filing, for example. This simple ad was a clear violation of the bar's rules against lawyer promotions. The Bar Association sought to punish Bates and Osteen. The two lawyers went to court to fight the punishment. They argued that their ad was a form of speech protected under the First Amendment. The case eventually made its way up to the Supreme Court in a case called Bates v. Arizona Bar. The court ruled in favor of Bates and Osteen. The First Amendment protected lawyer advertising, the court concluded. The result was that not only could lawyers advertise their services, hence the ubiquitous highway billboards and radio spots that you see and hear today, but they were also free to promote themselves and solicit clients. This set off an arms race for greater geographic reach, more lawyers, more clients, more money, more power. The legal profession had become the legal industry. Big idea number three. Lawyering, at least as it's practiced today at giant corporate law firms, is less and less about protecting clients who are accused of wrongdoing and more about things like fending off regulations and avoiding taxes. The book tells the story about what happened in the small town of Marion, Massachusetts, when the Board of Health tried to restrict the sale of flavored tobacco products. The idea had come from a newly elected public health official, a pediatric oncologist who knew firsthand the dangers of tobacco marketed at kids. For decades, the tobacco giant R.J. Reynolds had been represented by the law firm Jones Day, which repeatedly had tried to muddy the science about the dangers of smoking and the addictiveness of nicotine. Now, as Marion officials planned to restrict flavored tobacco, they rolled out a simple solution at the law firm. Noel Francisco, who would go on to be the Solicitor General in the Trump administration and at the time was a partner at Jones Day, wrote a four-page letter to Marion's elected leaders. The letter warned that if they enacted the rules, Jones Day would sue. Legal experts I spoke with said the letter's claims were weak at best. Other towns in Massachusetts and elsewhere had enacted similar restrictions. The Board of Health was specifically empowered to take this type of action, they said. But it cost virtually nothing to have a few associates type up a letter and then have Francisco sign it and then send it out in fancy overnight mail envelopes. One former tobacco lawyer at the law firm told me that they did this kind of thing all over the country. This was a really scary threat for a small town, especially since it was coupled with a well-organized lobbying campaign that targeted town officials even at their homes. Officials in Marion, who I spoke with, said that even the letterhead that Francisco had used in his letter, it was on thick cardstock and listed all of the dozens of offices that Jones Day operated around the world, exuded power and intimidation. The letter worked. After months of deliberating, town officials decided that they didn't have the stomach to risk a protracted and expensive legal battle with a global law firm like Jones Day. One town official publicly worried about being tarred and feathered. So the proposed tobacco rule was eventually abandoned. And the Board of Health official who had come up with the idea, he was so disgusted by what he saw that he gave up on holding elected office. Big idea number four. Even when lawyers cross ethical lines, they rarely get punished. The book has a chapter on Jones Day's work for Abbott Labs, the healthcare company that is a leading manufacturer of powdered infant formula. Over the years, many families have sued Abbott after their babies died or were severely brain damaged after they had consumed powdered formula. In one case that I detail in the book, the family of a little girl in Sioux City, Iowa, who was permanently brain damaged, sued Abbott. The family was poor, and its lawyers came from small firms. Jones Day pulled out all the stops. It buried the plaintiffs in paperwork. It tried to blame the family for being responsible for poisoning their daughter. A federal judge concluded that Jones Day's lawyers repeatedly engaged in improper legal tactics, including by essentially coaching witnesses on how to answer questions during depositions. That is a violation of legal rules. The federal judge in the case thought that this was part of a pattern in which big corporate law firms abused smaller law firms and plaintiffs. He ordered a Jones Day partner to produce an educational video for everyone else at her law firm that would teach them about the do's and don'ts of depositions. The judge figured this was the type of unconventional punishment that would get the attention not only of Jones Day, but of the entire corporate bar as well. Jones Day, however, appealed the penalty. They argued in part that the punishment was unfair because the judge hadn't warned them ahead of time about the specific type of penalty he might impose. An appeals court agreed, although it did not rule on whether the lawyer's conduct itself was appropriate. That decision allowed Jones Day to tell everyone that the judge's order had been overturned, and that was technically true, even if it didn't have a direct bearing at all on whether the Jones Day partner had acted properly. The lawyers in this case were never punished. Finally, big idea number five, pro bono work is not always what it seems. When I started this project, I assumed that pro bono work involved providing legal services to poor people and poor organizations. And that is true, but I realized that there's a lot more to it. Jones Day, for example, does a ton of pro bono work on the U.S.-Mexico border, where it helps migrants navigate the court systems. But the law firm is also doing a lot of pro bono work that does not fit that traditional definition. For example, it has helped deep-pocketed groups fight against things like voting rights. In 2012, Jones Day helped organize a multifaceted legal assault designed to cripple President Obama's signature legislative achievement, the new national healthcare law. And Jones Day had lawyers working pro bono on behalf of Donald Trump in 2016 and 17, after he won the election but before he took office. A bunch of Jones Day lawyers told me that they had voiced concerns internally about this. Helping Team Trump didn't seem to fit the traditional definition of pro bono work, but they were overruled by their higher-ups. Jones Day's defense is that pro bono work is supposed to be for the public good. And what's in the public good? Well, that's in the eye of the beholder. To me, it was a powerful reminder that when a big law firm, or really any other giant institution for that matter, boasts about all the good volunteer work they're doing, well, that's in the eye of the beholder too. Thank you for your time, and I hope you'll check out Servants of the Damned.
Thank you, David. That was David Enrich with five big ideas from Servants of the Damned, giant law firms, Donald Trump, and the corruption of justice. You might also want to listen to our book bite for This Is Not Normal, The Politics of Everyday Expectations by legal scholar Cass Sunstein. I'm Rufus Griscom. Thanks for listening.